Welcome everyone to the podcast Post Critical Psychogeographies from week resistance to week avant-garde. And this time I have the pleasure and honor to speak with my very dear friend and amazing academic and also recently activist, Agata Liszak, who is a professor at the Barth College in Berlin, who is an author of an amazing, amazing book about the urban studies and the city, and also author of multiple articles investigating how political legacies and political aspects and agency, I would say, hides in the small details of urban activism, urban architecture and organization and life of the cities. And you are working now on a project about postcolonial reading of Poland, no? No, you're not. Okay. I wanted to introduce your new book, but then I realized I don't have this one sentence to introduce it. So if you are willing, please go ahead and tell me, and then I'll ask my first question.
And that's not what I'm working on, but I am working on a book that engages with Rosa Luxemburg's theories to make sense of our present condition.
Fantastic. And this is my favorite project of yours. So my first question, this podcast would never begin, actually, without me listening to your podcast, Spatial Delight, which I totally recommend to everyone listening, which is available on the website of Sociological Review, the journal, and also on platforms. You told me about the presentation podcast as caring you once did for an academic conference. And I believe that there is no better way to introduce your podcast than by asking, how is your podcast Spatial Delight a form of caring?
Well, thank you, Eva, for the invitation. It's always a pleasure to talk to you with or without recording. It's a beautiful way to start a day, especially a lovely, sunny summer day in Berlin. I'm really glad and flattered that you like Spatial Delight, because especially when I share the podcast with academics, I'm always a bit cautious and a bit nervous about their responses, because the idea behind the podcast was to popularize the work of feminist and Marxist geographer Doreen Massey. So I didn't make it with academics in mind. I made it with a more general public in mind. And as you mentioned, I was recently invited to speak about academic podcasting and care. Feminist care, more specifically. It was an event at Goldsmiths in London that was put together by amazing sociologists Nirmal Pawar and Rosalind Gill. And I reflected on how the work on this podcast was, for me, intertwined with care. So care is not one of the main themes of the podcast. There are many other topics that we engage with, like around the politics of space. But in hindsight, I think that care is very central to this endeavor. And I don't think that podcasting offers more opportunities to practice care in academia than other formats. But as any other format, it is possible to practice it with care. So I think I tried doing this, and I was very encouraged and supported to do it with care by the people I worked with. So before the podcast even started, when I reached out to the Sociological Review with this idea of doing a 10-part podcast inspired by the work of Doreen Massey, the British sociologist Dev Skeks requested a meeting with me. So she requested a Zoom call with me to see who I was, why I wanted to do this, why about Doreen Massey. So she and Doreen Massey were friends before Doreen Massey died. And I experienced that request as a form of feminist care that she practiced posthumously towards Massey, right? So she wanted to make sure that the person who engages with Massey's work in such a public way, I guess, has good intention and good politics. So absolutely. It was a really beautiful interaction, I have to say. And Beverly Skeks herself has done a lot of work on care, and it very much shows in her approach also to this. So
That was important for me as well, that you were approaching different academics, different scholars and activists from the urban activism, from city rights perspective. And you were delivering actually incredibly politicized content, but in a way that might seem like, a little bit reportagey, a little bit academic. But so that clash of like very radical demands that those peoples had, whether they were professors of universities, whether they were, you know, commemorating Doreen Massey, or whether they were activists. So the radicalism of those claims and the incredibly, I would say, polite, caring, but also welcoming style of the narrative, both of your guests but also of yours, that was really something that I probably cannot entirely copy, although that part I would love to copy basically, but I cannot probably do, because making a podcast is also very much about the content. So, you know, so one might get easily driven, I think, by the fact like, oh, there is a logic to this interview, I want to capture it, I want to follow it. And then there's people and their individual approaches to everything, like yours, for instance, to the urban matters, to the podcast, to avant-garde, to everything. And and it's not easy, I think, to have this welcoming atmosphere, especially in an audio where people cannot see what kind of faces we do and what kind of gestures we apply or whatever else. So I found this super inspiring and fascinating. And I started thinking, okay, so I can do something that is going to be also, you know, like maybe polite and somehow polished. Although not to an extent that you have your podcast polished, but still. And yet to be capable of bringing some, you know, resistance strategies and avant-garde and other things that matter for me.
Maybe I just like very briefly follow up on this to say, because you mentioned that you can hear it, how, you know, like the caring relations with my interlocutors on each episode. It was important for me that this podcast is not extractive. I think like many other academic and non-academic formats, podcasts can be extremely extractive, right? It can just be, you know, like taking knowledge out of a talking head or a talking mouth in audio. And that's it, right? So like it was important for me that with the people I spoke to, that we had a lot of conversations leading up to it. And what you hear on the podcast is only like a fraction of what we talked about, that I feel like I was very, very lucky to build like beautiful relationships with the people I engage with on the podcast. And because that is not quantified, that is not visible, but it's still so important.
Yeah.
I cherish it very dearly. And in fact, like on the final episode of Spatial Delight, I speak about this with other academics, about care in academia or lack of care in academia, especially under precarious conditions, and who gets to have time to think with others. Right.
I'm kind of, you know, I'm also worried about this extractivism kind of thing, especially because my podcast is usually recorded with one take, as we don't have resources to like engineer it properly. So this can result, and I'm afraid it might result one day, with this kind of slightly, you know, like slightly more extractivist attitude in fact. And I'm not very proud of it, but I think that is a risk in this kind of strategy of recording. However, on the other hand, my podcast started with trying to figure out what are the voices of artists concerning this concept of weak avant-garde. So this was my initial intent. It was, okay, I'm building a theory, I'm going to interpret a lot of art with the use of this concept of weak avant-garde that I'm trying to work on. So I don't want to just go above the heads of the artists. I want to hear them. And I wouldn't necessarily agree with them. Maybe yes, maybe no. But I want to have this clarity concerning their intentions and their the results that they expect their art is going to have. And then my interpretation. And I want to, and this is what I've been doing always while writing about art and also curating the not many times that I did it. It was trying to make a very clear cut line of like, okay, the artist wanted to express this and that. And then I see some other things also. And some of those things were completely not predicted by the artist, or some of them even contradict the intent. And, you know, but I want the audience to have access to all the perspectives, to my perspective, but also to the perspective of others. And I think, this is, in my work, this is the main caring dimension. It's like to make sure that I don't do what interpretations of art have been doing for the last decades, especially in the 90s in Poland. You would have catalogs where curators and critics discuss everybody else's art, but not the artists that were actually exhibited, technically, about whom those catalogs are.
So just showing off what they know about art history rather than engaging with the work of the artist.
Exactly. So, you know, so my podcast also came from this need of gathering those voices, first as audio, then perhaps also in written. But then I felt like, okay, I can also talk with other theorists. Actually, I do engage with, you know, with the notion of care, I do engage. I'm gonna definitely reference your work on it in the podcast, but also in your text. So I want to know what lies behind. So my second question concerns my podcast a bit more, and it was called Postcritical Psychogeography because it suggests situationist and critical inspirations for the podcast and for me generally. Is there anything about psychogeography or critical theory that you find still inspiring? Also, are there things that you don't find inspiring? And if you could tell us why.
I am very drawn to psychogeography after feminists and anti-racist interventions. So not in its original, so to speak, version of the 1950s Paris, but the later iterations. So, of course, there's huge value in this playfulness that De Boer and others, encouraged in urban residents in the 1950s, and the anti-consumerist approaches to the city that I think are very much needed to reclaim space for alternative forms of engagement, or alternative economies, alternative politics. But when I first started reading their work, I didn't feel very drawn to how they executed it. So I think the idea is excellent. It's radical, but I lacked, I think, space for people other than white Western men, I guess.
Exactly.
But ever since then, there have been so many interventions into this field, and one that I am particularly drawn to is the work that is done by Morag Rose in Manchester, but also other British cities. Morag started this group many years ago that is called the Loiterers' Resistance Movement, and she organizes and participates in collective walks through Manchester and other cities. She actually has a book coming out with Pluto in a couple of months. It's going to be called The Feminist Art of Walking. I did some walks with Morag. And, you know, it's playful. It's anarcho-blanus, she calls it. It draws from performance art. It draws from activism. It draws from critical geography. So I'm excited about this book. And this is the kind of psychogeography that that I also incorporate in my own teaching.
Mm.
But what I see adjacent to psychogeography, and what I find much more attractive also in my teaching, but also in my practice, is the work of Yoko Ono and her map pieces, sissy pieces, walking pieces, because they just explode my imagination of how to interact with the urban. And one of my favorite ones is when she, in one of the sets of instructions collected in Grapefruit, where she says, stir inside of your brains with the penis until things are mixed well, take a walk, you know? And
yeah.
And she has so many of these of these invitations to subvert the urban space in where we live and how we are socialized to experience it. So I definitely think there's a lot of potential in psychogeography still, but not necessarily in the sort of like classical
version,
museified version, but rather like Rudo's, you know, but dialogues with artists like Yoko Ono, but also through more recent or contemporary geographers and activists. Yeah,
in Warsaw, I came to Warsaw in the late 90s, and I sort of came across immediately some post-situationist group that was already formed by Mateusz Kwaterko, the person who translated Guy Debord, and then also Giorgio Agamben into Polish, Maciej Gachewicz, Piotr Remarczyk, Adam Rycz, so people who were coming from anarchist movement, but then they were sort of exploring its more complex and more intellectually invested current. So they were following directly Guy Debord. And so what we were doing was basically appropriation of the High Parisian format of psychogeography into the territories of neoliberalizing Poland. So that was already, I think, a little bit of a clash with the original version, because they were not all so poor as myself, but we had definitely a poorer version of it. We didn't have Paris to explore. We had Warsaw to explore. And Warsaw, as you know, is totally marked by the Second World War. And especially such districts as Wola, who paid the price of, German anger, first with Jews, so the Warsaw Ghetto, mainly center Wola, and then Wola district that was erased as a payback from the Nazi Reich for the Warsaw Uprising of 1944. So if you go there, of course, you have this ultra-traumatized territory that where blood literally sank in the ground, in the pavements. And you have also plaques in Warsaw saying this place experienced the blood of Poles or Jews and Poles killed by the Nazis. So you have plaques that tell you about this blood. So I would say we were practicing bloody psychogeography, but there is like trauma that puts a very thick layer onto this slightly optimistic, I would say, like the initial moment of psychogeography is like, we don't give a shit about institutions, we don't care about establishments, we're going to explore the city ourselves, right? So it's a sort of effort from the bourgeoisie to go more plebeian in some sense. We're going to go to those abandoned places, empty standing buildings, we're going to maybe squat something. So there is this plebeization of bourgeoisie that is initial step. We were not entirely bourgeoisie, because bourgeoisie in Poland is a whole different story. However, I think that what was nice about this practice was actually the ability to also plan future squats and plan future ecological activism and things like that. So there was a direct connection between our escapades and actual activism that was happening. We're also producing a lot of critical discourse based on those excursions.
And I think also what is important to emphasize here is that you were doing this at a time when, the trauma of World War II was and still is very much present in the urban landscape, that you were doing it at a time of this galloping neoliberalization, not just of economy, but of urban space as well, right? So where, those temples of consumptions were emerging, but there was also like a lot of informal trade in between people, like with just like random stands at street corners. Sometimes it would just be a piece of cardboard, right, with like counterfeit perfume or bombs, right? Yeah, or like people would be selling products from the back of their cars, and it was all mashed up together. And I think that this approach, or like looking at that of Warsaw in the 90s through the practice of psychogeography, is also very attractive in your engagement with the work of Mariola Przyjemska, right? Because you talk about her also as a psychogeographer, kind of, oh, those were the liberal Warsaw.
Yeah, thank you for noticing this. And I do agree that I was taking it, because Mariola is a psychogeographer, natural born. She knew about Guy Debord when she was younger and when she started her artistic career. But I don't think she knew about psychogeography until later. And yet she would walk around the city. She lives in the city center. And she was observing this dismantlement, the destruction of very functional 1960s modernist blocks of flat because some capitalist neoliberals wanted to build skyscrapers in the center of Warsaw. So she, who also lives in 1960s modernist building on the 13th floor, so it's her really a perspective, could observe all those transformations in the city centers or the gentrification that came with it, evictions, you know, struggles of inhabitants and stuff like this. And she was documenting it in her paintings. And yes, this psychogeographic training that I got with my friends, who were, by the way, mostly men. There was one other woman in a whole group. And there were elements of, I would say, male privilege. Definitely in this practice. However, those very men educated with feminism in the later years. So I was really happy to see how most of them actually really transformed their attitudes towards women and towards gender as a factor in society and culture. So this psychogeography was very reflexive. And this is, I think, a part of it, which is always working well.
But then there's also, it's not just about being aware, but having the embodied experience, right?
Yes.
Of being a gendered person in the city, right? So as a young woman at that time, you experienced the city or the...
I was a tricky person, you know, but I wasn't entirely a woman. You know, I identified very much beyond gender. But from very early age of being a teenager, I was given this nickname, Maleństwo, which is Ru, like little kangaroo from Winnie the Pooh. And this is a neutral word in Polish. We have neutral. We almost use it, but it exists grammatically. So many people were asking me whether I want to go with neutral gender. So, and I was looking very much like somebody, but not really entirely feminine at the time. So for those guys, it was also an exercise to kind of like, oh, that's an, because for some of them, some of them tried to like court me or something, like to be, you know, they were also older than me, like 10 years or something older than me. So there was a lot of like effort. How do we work with this person who is like a woman by name, at least, or, you know, by gender classification in her documents. But then what the hell is she doing here? So there was a lot of like gender play. And as they were like intellectuals, very open to whatever experimentation, I think for me, it was a very liberating zone to have all these people around me who were curious and sometimes surprised by my gender, you know, impersonation. But they were also never on the banning side, on the censoring side of it. So I think there was something about me resisting the kind of classical feminine role and some of them struggling a little bit with it because they were still used to this very traditionalist strategy of letting a woman go first through the door and other things like that. And then suddenly I would be like, no, I let you go. And I was like double the size of some of them. So basically, you know, it was complicated. So there was a whole play like this. And I must say that this is also what drives me towards avant-garde, this openness to the new formats and experiments. This is the part of avant-garde that I really would love to save. And I was asking you, you know, whether you wanted to talk about avant-garde. You were like, not necessarily. And I get it because it's not in the center of your research. But I'm asking you as like fellow cultural studies scholar and fellow feminist, is there anything in the avant-garde that is worth preservation, is worth kind of, you know, like... working with, because I'm trying to focus on weaknesses, yes, and those small of it. So what do you think?
Yeah, you know, I'm into recycling and upcycling. So I don't think that a concept or an approach needs to be gotten rid of if it feels like the expiry date has passed, right? I think there's definitely still potential. I mean, like I work with concepts of but created by people who are no longer alive too, right? So like it's or like certain art movements or political movements that are past their heyday, let's say. I was hesitant to talk about it because I don't really engage with the concept of the avant-garde, right? But I'm drawn to avant-garde practices in arts, especially in music. Like in London, there's this fantastic bar club called Cafe Otto, and the experimental music that they promote is avant-garde through and through. It's always an amazing experience to not just to be exposed to this, but to sort of be included in that space. I'm interested in how you connect avant-garde with weak resistance in art. I do think that, I mean, we talk about art a lot now.
It's so often about avant art, but yeah.
Yeah, but also, you know, about inventive approaches that are not just formally inventive, but also politically meaningful in ways that they disrupt the everyday. And I'm thinking here about the work of Monika Drożyńska, for example, right, who does the stitching and embroidery, and who is like professionally trained in embroidery, but it's not always reflected in how she does it in public, right? Because of the, so like if she does it, for example, when she did it on Polish trains, embroidering or rather stitching various words and sentences into the backrests on the train, so interrupting the public space, you know, it wasn't like carefully executed art form because there was no time for this, right?
Yeah, it was also genius, though.
Yeah. So like that kind of work I feel very drawn to, and also because she has sticker versions of her pieces, right? So when I was in Warsaw recently, I was so happy to come across one just on this trio. I was like, oh yeah, like it, you know, it's fun. It's super smart. It's in many ways radical by embracing sort of like this very feminized generally, although not recently, there's been a lot of interest in embroidery and textile art or renewed interest in textile art also in established art spaces, I would say, not just in Poland, but also elsewhere in the West. But because she does her work not just in galleries and museums, but also in public space, that's something that I feel very drawn to.
Absolutely. Listen, we're going to have to finish the recording. So I'll thank you for now for this conversation. I mean, incredibly fascinating. So let's stop the recording on both sides if possible.